It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Murder Mile. Today, I'm standing on Bourchier Street in Soho, W1. At the back of the unsolved murder of Dutch Leia. A few doors down from the beating of baby Richard. A few doors up from the failed poisoning of Henry Hall's family. And one street north of the Stockholm Syndrome of Susan Latterney. Coming soon to Murder Mile. Bourchier Street is grim. It sounds posh, as the name originates from the French boursière, meaning keeper of the purse. Except the only purses unveiled in this drab little alley are the ones a little scroter's robbed so he can blow a tenner on enough skag to make a lightweight microbe mildly merry, or the kind a drunk gent's whittle dribbles down as he struggles to paint his own shadow in wee-wee. Oh yes, this is a real hovel, being little more than a dark alley hidden by the backs of brothels. Apparently. In 1945, Bourchier Street was worse than it is today, as 60 to 64 Old Compton Street had been hit by a 25-kilo bomb, which had reduced it to piles of rubble and burnt-out fascias. With no shops, this was little more than a place to take a sneaky detour, to empty your bladder, or to lay in wait for your next victim. At a little after 11:30 p.m., on Friday the 14th of September 1945, Captain John Ritchie of the Canadian Army was attacked on Bourchier Street by two British soldiers clutching half a brick. But why? This is a case less about the man who died or the men who did it, but how a war had shaped and then broke them. My name is Michael, I'm your tour guide, and this is Murder Mile. Episode 183, Captain J.A. Ritchie and the End of the War.
Today is Victory in Europe Day.
8th of May 1945, VE Day. Hitler is dead. Berlin has fallen. The axis of evil has been crushed by the might of the right. And the Second World War was just 4 months from its official end. For the first time in 6 years, as Big Ben rang out, street parties erupted as a grey gloom of people rejoiced. It had been a long-fought battle in which so many had died and so much had been lost. But now, for those who had survived, their lives would return to some kind of normality. 12 days later, Captain J.A. Ritchie would be beaten to death. born on the 3rd of August 1920. Robert Blaine would be a lifelong resident of Southwark, a borough just south of the River Thames. Formerly of Borrett Road in Walworth, few records survive of his early years, except that he was an average working-class man who had little or no contact with his family. On the 29th of September 1939, 3 weeks into the war, the National Registration Act was introduced. Every British subject was issued with an identity card and their details were taken. Robert was listed as a 19-year-old general labourer living at 6 St. Clair Chambers on Sylvester Street, barely scraping by on a basic wage, with very little to call his own. His life was tough and exhausting. Robert Blaine was an ordinary man, living an unremarkable life. And yet his life was about to become extraordinary, whether he liked it or not. When we think about the lives of those who lived through the Second World War, we think of rationing, mistakenly believing that this skirmish would be done by Christmas. In January 1940, the Ministry of Food introduced rationing, and each person was limited to a weekly allowance of 8 ounces of sugar, 3 ounces of sweets, 4 ounces of ham, 3 pints of milk, 2 ounces of tea, cheese and butter, with 1 egg and 1 pack of dried eggs every 4 weeks. In comparison to today, if the average coffee shop patron guzzles a large cafe latte, a muffin and a cheese and ham toasty, they would have annihilated more than half their weekly ration in one sitting. But there were many more measures and ramifications which impinged on the people and their lives. Wartime memories are often littered with the rose-tinted recollections of those who cherry-picked the chaos to create a myth of Blitz spirit. It's romantic, but it's inaccurate. It's true that amidst the bombing and destruction, that we, the plucky British people with our stiff upper lips, flipped a mid-digit to Adolf by refusing to be defeated as his Luftwaffe rained down death from the skies. But the same was true of the Germans, whose cities our bombers had failed to cripple, and its people to break. Another myth was that there was no crime and you could leave your doors open. But as we know, with history written by the victors, who believed that they had won the right to edit the bits of their history they didn't like, the good old days are often remembered for what they should have been instead of what they were. In reality, war is brutal, and life during any conflict is oppressive. Within the blink of an eye, the world of so many decent people was turned upside down, with everything they had known either changed or gone. For criminals, it was a boom time, which is why many prisons were emptied of anyone with 3 months or less to serve, making space for spies, but mostly for the real criminals, like looters, spivs, and deserters. But even for the average Joe, with good morals, who could still proudly claim, "I never broke the law," low-level criminality was absolved, as the buying of black market goods was the equivalent of a little white lie. On a single day in November 1940, the Old Bailey heard 20 of the 56 cases for looting during the Blitz. Across just 4 months, 4,584 cases were tried of those who had stolen from the bombed-out homes of their neighbours. often stepping over the dead or dying, to ransack the remnants of their shattered lives. So rife was the looting, that when a building was bombed, the police had to spend more time protecting the property than searching for survivors, as a home could be stripped in just 20 minutes. Times were difficult, ethics were a grey area, and the rationale of the living was that they had families to feed. Rationing had also led to one of the most lucrative black market activities, the forging of ration coupons. In 1944, 14,000 ration books were stolen in a raid, many of which were sold on Oxford Street for £10 a sheet, with a value today of £400 each, or £3 million for the entire haul. Many ordinary people wouldn't have seen this as an offence, as in their eyes, it's not a crime if everyone's at it. Besides, we're at war. By March 1941, 2,300 people had been prosecuted for fraud and dishonesty. In 1943, 5 million clothing coupons were stolen. And by 1945, there were more than 114,000 prosecutions for black market sales. With the government compensating those who had lost their homes to the tune of £500, systems were open to abuse, as we have seen during COVID. In one case, Walter Handy of Wandsworth made a successful claim for the bombing of the same house 19 times over 5 months. In the end, he received 3 years free food and accommodation, courtesy of the British government, in Wandsworth Prison. But the prisons weren't only full of pilferers. As in wartime, simply standing up for your rights had become a crime, as it was illegal to go on strike. In 1942, miners at the Kent Colliery went on strike over working conditions. Their leaders were arrested, but unable to imprison the 1,000-strong pit. Many were fined, but almost none of them paid. And as for the notion that we knew everyone and all looked out for one another, the facts simply don't back that up. As in so many murders, as with the Blackout Ripper, the neighbours of these lone women who were living in the same building would later comment how strange it was that they hadn't been seen or heard from for days. And yet no one went to see if they were okay. Which is not to say that today we are any better or worse. But though we haven't had the luxury of time to gloss over the inconvenience of truth. Wartime was difficult, existence was hard, and it forced even ordinary people to do desperate things. That was the world that Robert Blaine was living in, only with one big difference. Being in his early 20s, he'd been conscripted to fight. On the 3rd of September 1939, the day Britain declared war on Germany, Parliament passed the National Service Act, ordering all medically fit males aged 18 to 41 to fight for king and country. One of the 1.5 million men conscripted to fight was 19-year-old South London labourer Robert Blaine. Like anyone else, We don't know his morals, his ethics, his hopes, his dreams, or his politics. But it can't have been easy. Overnight, he was uprooted, his life ripped apart. And given limited training, he was forced to fight, to shoot, and to kill. To murder a mass of strangers in a foreign country, for a reason he may not have fully understood, with the knowledge that he may end up dead, disabled, or deranged. Everywhere he looked, he was told, "It's your duty to fight, to kill, to give your life for king and country." And although millions of soldiers did, this trauma would stay with them for the rest of their lives. Through the prism of our modern-day lives, you may think he had the right to say no. But he didn't. With prisons cleared for deserters and conscientious objectors, regardless of their political or religious beliefs, they were seen as the true enemy. Many men were shamed into fighting by their loved ones, even though the fifth commandment is "Thou shalt not kill." In a Christian faith, which during the Second World War, 64% of the British population claimed that they were. By the war's end, 500 objectors were court-martialed. 17 were sentenced to death, although none were carried out. 150 objectors were imprisoned for life. Many were harassed and beaten, and the bulk would suffer a huge stigma. If a serving soldier committed a criminal offence, like theft, assault, or drunkenness, their status as a valued member of society meant that the police and law courts often downgraded or turned a blind eye to their crimes. And yet for the crime of not doing your duty, the sentence could be severe. During World War I, 306 British soldiers were shot for desertion. Not murder, not terrorism, but for refusing to fight. But with this deemed illegal, according to the 1929 Geneva Convention, other punishments were enacted. During World War II, if you went absent without leave, you could serve anything from 2 years to life. Pretending to have an illness or injury to avoid service, the crime of malingering was also punishable by 2 years in prison. And for the crime of misconduct towards a superior officer, you could expect up to 10 years in prison. Conscripted in 1939, Private Robert Blaine was an infantryman in the British Army. As a labourer who had harboured no dreams of an army life, he had endured the harsh regime of the military for 6 years. That's 6 years of chowing down on substandard rations, marching like drones at the crack of dawn, being barked at by bullies who were too shy to fight, and routinely punished for minor misdemeanors, like not bullying his boots to a mirror shine, or daring to speak his own mind in the earshot of a sergeant. With very little freedom, and no idea when this legally enforced torture would end, we know that Robert Blaine sometimes adopted the alias of Reginald Douglas Johnson, and often he deserted his post.
Today is Victory in Europe Day. Tomorrow,
8th of May 1945, VE Day. But let us not forget for a with the war as good as over, many enlisted men faced several futures. Some tried to return to the civilian lives they had left behind. But their world had gone. No job, no home, no wage, and no purpose. For others, with the war technically over, many serving soldiers had their pay cut. The government hadn't considered giving them a pension for their sacrifice. And for many, as new regimes popped up, as old enemies died, their conscription had only just begun. Rationing remained for another decade, with bread added to the list of ration basics in 1946. And as a new crime wave swept across Britain, unemployment rose, goods were slim, and to make a few quid, many soldiers sold off their guns, which flooded the streets. During the post-war years, it was said it was safer to fight overseas for your country than to live at home on the streets of our cities. The Second World War officially ended on the 2nd of September 1945. During the celebrations, Robert Blaine went AWOL. The war was over. But still under conscription, he was classified as a deserter. As a born and bred Londoner, now 25, Robert Blaine had returned to the one place he knew, London. He had left behind a pristine city, and what he had returned to was a smouldering ruin of black smoke, bomb craters, and chaos. Everything he knew or owned was gone. His home, his job, and his belongings. And worse still, having left the battlefields behind, the city was now a sea of death and destruction. In the year prior to his conscription, the annual homicide rate in England and Wales was roughly 400 people a year. One year later, as bombers obliterated the city, that rose to 400 people per day. Mortuaries were overwhelmed. Bodies lay unburied. The dismembered limbs of loved ones littered the rubble-strewn streets. Morgue vans became as familiar as the ice cream trucks once were. And the city's swimming pools were drained to keep the dead bodies cool until their remains could be claimed. A new epidemic was ravaging the streets, and its name was death. Between 1939 and 1945, the crime rate in England and Wales rose by 57%, with the number of reported murders doubling in just 5 years. With a decimated police force, many cases went unsolved, as it was almost impossible to prove or disprove a person's disappearance during wartime and the Blitz. Rape was up, robbery was up, manslaughter was up. And with many citizens and servicemen seeing a black person for the very first time, London experienced race riots and even lynchings in the West End. And yet, more than 80 years after the event, there was one other conspicuously silent massacre which is rarely spoken about by those who lived through these darkest of days. When war was declared, the British government formed NARPAC, the National Air Raid Precautions Animals Committee, whose job it was to advise pet owners. Worried that many people couldn't afford the luxury of a cat or dog, their freely distributed pamphlet advised, if you cannot place them in the care of neighbours, it really is kindest to have them destroyed. Alongside an advert for a bolt pistol. Appealing for calm over this unnecessary hysteria, veterinarian groups like the PDSA and the RSPCA were against such drastic instructions. But with their hospitals swamped by worried owners, more than 750,000 pets were legally destroyed, many in the first few weeks of the war. It is still unclear how many family pets were murdered during the panic, as many were drowned, shot, or strangled. It was hardly a welcome home for Robert, but everyone's life had been altered forever. With nothing but the uniform on his back and a few shillings in his pocket, he couldn't just restart his life. As without discharge papers, he couldn't get work. Without a national ID card, he couldn't get a ration book. Without a furlough pass, he risked being arrested for simply walking the streets. All of which left him with just one option: to commit crime. During his desertion, Robert met up with 19-year-old Charles Connolly, also known as Jock, a stockily built Glaswegian who'd been arrested as a stowaway on board the HMS Europa. Fleeing from the military police in Plymouth, he had broken free of his handcuffs, resulting in a wound to his right hand. Both men were hungry, broke, on the run, and their only crime was wanting their old lives back. On Friday the 14th of September 1945, the night that Captain J.A. Ritchie would die, Robert Blaine and Charles Connolly were in Soho, a dangerous den of iniquity, but with bars and brothels on each street, where syphilis-raveled servicemen spread the diseases that sex workers were unfairly blamed for. The intersections of Old Compton Street was the perfect place for a deserting soldier to hide in plain sight. Soho, especially at night, was deadly. Dubbed London's murder spot, over the previous 18 months, Scotland Yard and the Home Office had become gravely concerned about this deadly square mile. With many people describing Soho as a no-man's land, the unlit streets of this patch, renamed Little Chicago, was awash with theft, looting, drunkenness, assault, extortion, drugs, prostitution and death. As gangs of civilians and servicemen engaged in street fights with guns, knives, and knuckle dusters. Prior to this little-known murder, which barely bothered many journalists' ink, Superintendent Parker and Divisional Detective Inspector Stevens of West End Central informed the military authorities that they were busy enough with the civilian crime without needing to deal with these military hooligans. That night, with the Canadian and US military patrols having been doubled on the streets from Soho down to Victoria, in a bid to clean up the West End and to whisk away any troublemakers, so seriously was this taken that all US military police had been reissued with loaded firearms. At roughly 11:30 p.m., Captain John Alexander Ritchie, a 41-year-old Canadian officer, was taking a shortcut from Dean Street to Wardour Street through the bombed-out remains of Bouchier Street. It was dark, isolated, and he had enjoyed a few drinks that night. As being on leave from the Hampshire depot in Tweedsmuir, he was due to be repatriated back home to Montreal. This thin, unlit alley was, and still is, a bottleneck at the best of times. Once you're in, it's hard to get out, especially if you're cornered by two hoods, hidden in the shadows, as there's nowhere else to run. Being drunk and outmanned, Captain Ritchie was robbed, and possibly having fought back, one of the desperate deserters had smacked the officer over the head with half a brick. And as he lay bleeding and unconscious, the other deserter rifled his pockets, stealing £5 in notes, or just 2 weeks of their army wage. Found a few minutes later, Captain J.A. Ritchie died of his injuries at 11:45 p.m. Pursued by two constables, Charles Connolly escaped and was never found. Seen hiding in a doorway, Robert Blaine, who was thin, hungry, and had clearly been sleeping rough for weeks, was arrested and the half a brick was found inside of his jacket and taken into evidence. When questioned, he stated, "I didn't do it. He hit him while I was holding him," admitting to the robbery, but blaming Connolly for the killing. Tried at the Old Bailey on the 16th of November 1945, the prosecution would allege that although it could not be proven whether he had struck the fatal blow which killed Captain Ritchie, there was clear evidence that he had taken part in the assault. Summing up, the judge would state, "Where two persons are engaged in a robbery with violence and the victim dies, they are both guilty of the murder. It is quite immaterial which one of them gave the fatal blow." Being sentenced to death and with his appeal dismissed, Private Robert Blaine was executed on the 29th of December 1945 by hangman Albert Pierpoint. For many, the end of the war didn't mark a return to normality, as their lives and their trauma would last a lifetime. As the victors, it's easy to romanticize the conflict and to cherry-pick the facts. But what that does is to erase and devalue the hardship and the struggle that the average person endured. War was hard. Life was hard. And many people made sacrifices, both physically and morally, to survive. To forget the real truth is a disservice to those who gave up their life and sanity to protect us. As during these desperate times, even good people were driven to kill for just a few pounds.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Oh, Friggy McFrig face of Frighampton. Oh, I'm having a swig of water. Oh, Christ. Hey, everyone, welcome to Extra Mile. Oh, I'm trying to get myself ahead of the game because we've got the Crime Con thing happening soon. So we're going to go to Glasgow for that, and I want to go and see my dad and my stepmum. Oh, so I've tried to, instead of giving myself time off, which I rarely do anyway, I'm powering ahead, trying to get a couple of days ahead, and I'm just, I'm knackered. But I thought that was a good episode, I enjoyed that. Anyway, sorry, let me take off your hat. There we go. There's your hat taken off. There you go. You can now probably hear me as I move around. Oh, did I say welcome to Extra Mile Unedited, Unscripted? This is the waffly bit. The waffly bit that people seem to like. I don't know why. I'm gonna make a cup of tea, because do you know what? It's not hot out today. It's all right. So, I prepped this one already. Oh, there we go. Done. That's prepped. Ooh, I'm going to have some fish sticks in a second, because I haven't eaten all day. It's Sunday afternoon. I've been powering through to get this done, and I'm knackered. Oh, so I'm going to go into Costa in a bit. It gives me a little walk into town, go into Costa, sit down, have a coffee, charge up all my equipment. I'm working on something special for when we've got a break coming up. Because I need to finish doing the research on the final kind of 8 to 10 episodes to finish the year off, so I need 3 weeks to kind of really get that right. It'd be lovely if I just sat down and just waffled on about shite I read on Wikipedia, but I don't do that. So I've got to get it right. So I'm planning something interesting on the 3 weeks while we're away, something different. But I'm trying to get that written. I'm writing that in my spare time while I'm doing this. Anyway, got nothing left. Tea's on the go. Right, what's going on in the world? Oh, news. I posted it on social media. This would be like 2 weeks ago by the time you get this, but I've totally forgotten to mention it on here. Murderwell Walks, the walking tour of Soho that I used to do every Sunday morning. My plan originally was to bring back a new version. I'd written it, I'd researched it. Well, obviously, you research it first, then you write it. And the plan was to kind of bring it back. As soon as I started rehearsing it, I just realised I don't have any love for it anymore. I've done it for 8 years, I'm done. So it's finished, unfortunately, it's over. It won't be coming back. So, just to say, if you have a ticket that hasn't been used or a voucher, get in touch with me, email me, I will refund you. That's not a problem at all, sorry about that. I know for some people I had said that I was going to transfer their ticket to the new tour, but unfortunately that's not going to happen now. Or we can do what I did with the other one. We raised around £200 last time, so some tickets that weren't used, some people said, I'd said, if you want, I can convert that ticket, because obviously the money's already in my account, I can convert that into a donation to go to St Mungo's. So last Christmas we gave £200 to St Mungo's, which was great. So if you want a refund, message me. I can give you a refund. That's not a problem. If you want it to go to St Mungo's, that's good as well. Message me. Just say, can my ticket to go to St Mungo's? I'll do that. And I'll let everyone know how much money we raised, which is good. You provide bedding and food and services for homeless people of Soho and surrounding areas, which is great. Or some people have just said, forget it, I don't care. So I'm sorry about that. That was the plan, to do Murder Mile Walks, but my heart's just not in it anymore. Whereas the writing and the research, I loved, absolutely loved it. I was like, oh, this is going to be great. But the researching and getting ready to do a walk, I'm just not interested anymore. So the research will probably go into more episodes for Murder Mile, the podcast. or new projects that I'm working on for the future. That's what I want to do, is really focus on new stuff going forwards, not old stuff going backwards. And unfortunately, the walks, although they were nice, bit of a step backwards, I felt. Just didn't excite me, so sorry about that. But all good. All good. That means more episodes of Murder Miles, which is great. So there we go. Is my tea about to brew? Let's get it before it brews, before it gets too hot. Yeah, there we go. A little bit of steam. A midge was trying to jump into my face. Little bastard. Eva won't be happy about that. She'll be like, who is that midge? How dare he, she, what? What else is going on? As mentioned at the start of the episode, we're taking How to Plan the Perfect Murder and then Totally Balls It up to Manchester. Manfred, our kid, Manfred. Thank you to everyone who came to Glasgow, and London. I can't really do a London accent. Everyone was really lovely and it was great fun and we had fun. And do you know what? It's lovely to meet you. So with the Manchester one, what I'm getting the lads to do, Adam and Paul and myself, we're going to make the meetup a little bit longer. Instead of half an hour, you can turn up an hour early, do a meet and greet. I think it's a nicer idea that we can mingle and meet and have a chat for an hour first, have a couple of drinks, and then we'll do the show. So that's the plan for the new one. Slightly smaller venue, so there's less tickets. So I would, if you're planning to come to this, it's 4th of October. Yeah, 4th of October, I think. You can go to murdermiletours.com/live tour. I think it is, or live shows. The link's in the show notes. All the details are there. That's all good. What else is going on? I've written getting ahead here. What does that even mean, Michael? It's nice and cool outside, which is lovely. It's a nice sunny day. It's not too hot, which is great. The heat wave is FRO'd, which is lovely. As mentioned, I'm going to go off to Costa in a bit. I'm going to go and pick up some food. I'm back on my diet again because I realised the other day that I was like, oh, I should really go and get some cake. And then I looked in my bread bin and in there was like three or four different types of cake, three or four different types of biscuits, three or four different types of chocolate. And I just thought, yeah, your diet, it's absolutely gone, which is why my belt is struggling a bit. So I'm trying to keep myself down to one fun day a week. So I had some beer last night, I had some crisps, I had some wheat-free cakes, which is nice. Oh, it's good timing. Someone's just started pulled out a strimmer outside. I think it's over in the field opposite. Good, that won't bother me too much because we're doing this bit. So that's all good. So yeah, back on the diet, trying to be good. Unfortunately, I think I've got to an age where it's easy to get fat, isn't it? Just like you have like an ounce of sugar and it just goes blip out. What else is going on? Going to move the boat early in the morning. I've started moving the boat at like 5 in the morning now, which I love. Especially where I am, because there's a couple of locks around here where all the people come out and they all look at the boats going past, and it's fascinating. There's a lock just down from here, it's near a park, and all the people come out with their families and their kids and all sit there, and they sit on the lock itself, and you're trying to get your boat through, and then you have to say to them, sorry, can you move off the lock, because I need to open the gates, and they're like, what do you mean, I'm not moving, oh, we're on a picnic. And it's like, such morons. You just say, this is a working lock, we're trying to get boats through, and you can't because you and your brood won't FRO. Oh, so that's why I move in the morning, because no one's there and it's really peaceful and you can have a cup of tea and yeah, lovely. Oh, life is good. Oh, new Patreon supporter. I just want to say thank you to Karen Mempis. I hope I pronounced that right. Mempis, yes. Thank you, Karen, for becoming a Patreon supporter. That's very kind of you. I think I'm doing it tonight. There's some goodies in the post that I'm doing for you tonight. I haven't actually checked that you've put your address on there. Maybe you have, maybe you haven't. And I'll send you some goodies as a thank you. But there's loads of goodies online, loads of photos. Crime scene photos that no one will ever see anywhere else, because I don't share them anywhere else. If you're a patron supporter, I like to kind of ensure that this is kind of your stuff. And not with the videos, unfortunately, because YouTuber assholes with their kind of restriction rights. Really annoying. Oh, I'd love to have a private page where I could just have videos for patron subscribers, but I can't, unfortunately. So that's that. Let me go and grab that tea, and then we'll get into some questions. Lots of noise outside. Oh, look, two ducks. I seem to be in an area where there's no ducks. And I don't understand why. I've had weeks and weeks of being in areas where there's ducks and a swan and... I was watching a not a roe deer, what are they called, the little ones, muntjac yesterday. Normally they're quite timid and they disappear really quickly, but one was just walking in front of me and he was having a mooch around and he looked at me, he didn't seem that bothered and he just mooched off. Classic muntjac. What time is it? 10 to 2. I will get to Costa 3:30. That's 2 hours. Oh, right. Let's get this done. Four. Here's some quiz questions. We'll do quiz questions, then we'll do some extra stuff in Extra Mile. Right. Here you go. Don't forget, as always, I might balls these up because I haven't edited the episode yet. Question number one. If you know your history, this should be easy. What date was VE Day? Question number two. If you know your Murder Mile history, this should be easy. Which two murders mentioned in Murder Mile happened before and after, immediately before and immediately after VE Day? So we've done two episodes prior, which happened immediately before or after VE Day. What were they? Question three. What foodstuff was first rationed after the end of the Second World War? Question four, roughly how many looting cases did the Old Bailey hear during the war? Now with this one, it was a big number. So if you're within 100, I'll give you this point. Question five, how much was a ration sheet sold for on the black market? Question six. What was the name of the man who claimed that his home had been bombed 19 times over 5 months? Question 7. I can't remember if I said 6 at the last one. This is question 7. How many soldiers were executed for desertion in World War II? Question 8. What year was the Geneva Convention? Question 9. How many years in prison would you get for malingering? Good word. And question 10. What was Robert Blaine's alias? So there you go, folks. Let's dive into some extra stuff. Now, this was one of those cases that I wasn't going to cover originally. Because the archive file isn't available for ages and there's very little in the press and what is in the press is wrong. Hence, I know people will get in contact with me and they go, they always pull this face when they want to disprove me. They go, he wasn't murdered on Bouchier Street. He was murdered on Kingley Street. Or some people will say it was Romilly Street. It wasn't. I actually really, really... the press got it entirely wrong. They said it was Kingley Street. They said it was Romilly Street. It wasn't. It was Bouchier Street. I really had to fight to get these details right because the original archive files aren't available, but I got some of the police details. So it is. It's on Bouchier Street. There we go. I had someone messaged me the other day going... to do with an episode, and they went, everything you wrote was entirely wrong. I suggest you reread it carefully. And I messaged them to say, well, thank you for that. If you could send me a list of everything that I did wrong, and a list of your sources to disprove this, that would be very much appreciated. I will reread it carefully. No reply. As always, no reply. People are happy to tell me that I'm wrong, but you ask them to prove it and they can't. And when they do, they send me like a link to the Daily Mail and I just go, oh, I can't be asked to tell you what a fucking moron you are. Oh, I love being disproved. And I love when people go, here's some details. And because I think it's always really important to not believe that you know too much because we don't know enough, and knowing more is really valuable. It's like expanding your brain is so important. But some people just, they want to believe they're right and they don't want to know anything different. And it's just like, oh, for fuck's sake. Oh, anyway. So, yeah, Bouchier Street. It is correct. It took me a long time to prove that. This was originally was going to be part of the book that I was writing about Soho. I decided to turn this into an episode. There was a couple of other stories coming up that were going to be in the book. That's not going to happen anymore, which I'm turning into Murder Mile. Lucky you, get it for free. Also, they will be part of the new exciting projects that I'm working on at the moment for the future, and those will be things that you can take part in as well. So do you know, it's win-win. What do we know about Robert Blaine? Not a hell of a lot. Born 3rd of August 1920, raised in Southwark. We don't know very much. He didn't seem to have any friends or family who attended the trial. He isn't married. We don't know about his brothers and sisters. We know roughly where he lived, but that's long since been demolished. He was a labourer, but that's kind of a general occupation. So all we really know was from the National Registration Act that he was 19 years old at the time. He registered. He was a general labourer. He lived alone at 6 St Clair's Chambers on Sylvester Street in Southwark, which is just south of St George the Martyr. Now, this was part of the Metropolitan Association for Improving the Dwellings of Industrious Classes. Same as mentioned in this episode, same as the Peabody buildings. This was kind of what they wanted to do was create buildings which were kind of clean and respectable, where people who were kind of the industrial classes, as they called them, people who worked in factories, could have a cheap, affordable kind of identifiable kind of in these big premises. You got in this one there were 93 rooms for single people and 21 two-bedroom departments. Most of them were for men because, obviously, with Peabody, the focus really was on women and families. But what they realised at the same time was there was a lot of single men, so they needed places for single men, which is what this became. So they housed loads of people, lots of different types of people that live there. If you look at the census, there's carpenters, labourers, bricklayers, metal turners, lumber dealers, hawkers, steel traders, printers, canvassers, joiners, meat porters, street musicians, tailors, news vendors, kitchen boarders, most of whom were men, but some were women and children, and there were some families as well. But Robert didn't seem to have a family of his own. We don't know why. I'm going to have a slurp of tea. Ooh, cup of tea. You can hear the that sound you can hear is the it sounds like the guys are coming past who normally do the weed whacking around, along the canal, and it's nice that they do that because it gets rid of all the nettles and all the shite like that. But the problem is it spins around and it flies little sharp pieces of grit everywhere, and sometimes it goes through your window and you can't claim off them, which is a real pain in the ass. I can hear them, I can't see them. Anyway, the crime epidemic joint. This was what I wanted to get across with this episode. Same with Emmy Werner. What I wanted to get across was that we all seem to have this romanticised idea of World War II, you know, because we won it and therefore we're the victors, and therefore we like to see it as nice and everybody loved each other. But as you can see with Emmy Werner, what I wanted to get across with that is that when the war ended, everyone didn't just go, oh, it's ended, let's go back to our normal lives. Especially with the Jewish population, there was a lot of trauma that lasted for a lifetime and generations. With this one, what I wanted to get across was that it's not all lovely and lovey-dovey and everything was great. And it was like, do you know, I even have a photo of my granddad and my grandmum, and Trafalgar Square granddad's in his military uniform and they're hugging, and you know that it was VE Day. They were with everyone else celebrating. Everything was great, but it's not like that. War was really difficult, and that's what I wanted to get across with this, is that even for ordinary people, life was difficult. Which is not to say that Robert and Charles were right to do what they did, or that gives them an excuse for doing what they did, but they're just ordinary people, because of the rules and the ramifications that were going on during those 6 years and even longer, that it forced a lot of people into some really difficult situations and to do things that they would never normally do, such as commit robbery, desertion, murder someone. So you can really hear them now. It's like a big nest of bees. So yeah, looting was absolutely rife. I'm not going to go into that because that will give away one of the questions. Well done, Michael. As mentioned in this, when buildings and houses were bombed out, the police and the ARP wardens were there pretty much to protect the property, because they had to stop people going in and stripping the houses. And then when the fire engines and ambulance turned up, their job was to protect the fire engines and the ambulance. I know we like to have this idea that everyone was like looking after each other, and do you know what, wherever you are, there will always be good people who are good and decent and will do their job and will help other people, but you'll always have shitheads. I just sent a video online of some little wankers yesterday on Oxford Street, and they decided to go into the American candy store, and they basically stripped it. Like 20 little wankers went in there, rushed the store, stealing stuff. Like going, yeah, man, me is stealing Milky Ways and Mars bars in it. Me is gangster. It's just like, you're not a gangster, you're a twat stealing sweets. But that's the thing, isn't it? There are good people in the world and bad people in the world. And some people need a good kick up the arse. Oh. They're getting even nearer. I don't know whether they're getting nearer or whether they're over the other side of the canal. But they, as you can hear, they're very noisy. What else is going on? Black marketeering. I'm not going to go into that because that gives away some of the questions that we did. But as you can see, especially with ration books, because so many people's lives were dictated by the ration books, I'm going to have to close a window because that is... Oh, it's getting nearer and nearer, and it's getting... I'm glad it's happening now during this and not when I'm recording the main bit, because that's really annoying. What was I saying? Can't remember what I was saying. I've lost the plot now. Lots of prosecutions. Like, this is the thing that I always find fascinating when people go, oh, during the war there was no crime. And it's like, have you looked at the stats? Have you bothered to look at the figures? And it's like when people talk about the 60s and they go, oh, about the 60s. But everyone I spoke to was kind of there in the 60s. They don't remember the swinging 60s. They just remember it as being a regular time. I think there's a lot of people there's a small pocket of people who were involved in the swinging 60s. But for everyone else, it was just the 60s, you know. What am I talking about? I can't remember. Striking. Oh, with the striking. So I might clarify some of that, because sometimes with these things, you can't always put everything in. Workers' rights were made illegal, effectively. Striking was made illegal. It became illegal under defence regulations in order to ensure that the wartime industrial output was maintained at a maximum. Inevitably, this became problematic. In 1942, the miners' strike at the Kent Colliery led to the imprisonment of the miners' leaders, and they threatened the imprisonment of a 1,000-man workforce if they didn't pay their fines. Obviously, the government really couldn't do much at this, because you've got 1,000 men who are coal miners and you really badly need them. What are you going to do? You're going to fine them? You're going to send them all to prison, of which you don't have space? Or you're going to say, well, what you're doing is bad and we will fine you, but we know you can't afford it, so we might let you off. They kind of shot themselves in the foot on this one, the government. Compensation, as mentioned, same as with COVID, there was a scheme going on to kind of help people. Oh, looks like they've gone. It looks like they're on the other side of the canal, which is weird, because the other side of the canal is wooded, and I don't know why they were there. The Strimmer guys, anyway. What was I about to do? Oh, yeah, con men. During the Blitz, one standard ruse for thieves was to kit themselves out with an ARP, which is an air raid precautions, warden's helmet and armband, and then smash their way into shops when no one was looking. this was kind of the era. You know, the ARP warden was kind of really important and was respected, and people kind of listened to what they said because they had the authority to do so. And quite often, people would just make a little air raid warden's helmet and armband, load up their car with shit and drive off. But as mentioned in this episode, it's not... Yes, there were gangs who were kind of targeting London, but it's about ordinary people as well. It's fascinating when you look at people's lives in that era and you can see, like, especially with ordinary women as well, there were lots of women who did turn to prostitution. And it's a grey area, it really is, the term prostitution, because many women weren't sex workers, they were escorts. And escorts or call girls are kind of very different in their own different way, but it's still regarded as prostitution. It's like I was reading up something yesterday about brothels, as you do. And it was said that, like, I've read so many cases of people being charged with running a brothel, but it doesn't. That doesn't necessarily mean that you're running a brothel. Like, if you're... A policeman in say the 1940s could accuse you of being a prostitute if you were a woman and you were alone and you were seen in the same place three times by him. He could accuse you of prostitution without evidence, and therefore you would have a criminal record for prostitution even though you hadn't engaged with another man or solicited for money. Brothel keeping, that's even greyer in that area. So apparently, if you're a prostitute, and you are in the same room as another prostitute, if your maid is with you, therefore, even though she's not the prostitute, therefore she can be charged with running a brothel because two prostitutes are in the same room. Baffling, isn't it? So even though it's this wonderful book I'm reading, I can't remember which, thank you to whichever listener recommended it. It was the book on the Soho prostitutes, which I'm really enjoying at the moment. I've powered through half of it already. By the time you listen to this, I would have done the whole lot. And it's I really enjoyed it. But there's loads of little details that, it's nicely written, but there's loads of details that she's deliberately not said where she is. And there's places that I'm kind of having to work out where they are. I think she's either on Peter Street or she's on Tilbury Court, but I'm not too sure. I'm still learning. But yeah, there's loads of details that I never knew, so it's really fascinating. One other detail that obviously went into this case was the British Pet Massacre. The bits of details are online, so you can have a look at that. People are starting to talk about it a little bit more now, as they should. But as mentioned, when war came out and they'd already started by this point to say, you know, we're going to need to ration food. Owners would have to make a decision about whether they split their rations with their pets, because obviously the government wouldn't be rationing food for pets. They wouldn't say, like, you have so much money for pets. If you have a pet and you've got some bacon and you've got some bits and pieces and things like that, that's what your pet eats, not... You know, they don't ration out the dog food and say, let's make sure there's enough food for pets. Therefore, there was kind of a real worry that a lot of pets and animals will be left to starve. So NARPAC, as they were called, published a pamphlet titled Advice to Animal Owners. It suggested moving their pets from the big cities into the countryside, which obviously they did with a lot of their children. It concluded, if you cannot place them in the care of neighbours, it really is kindest to have them destroyed. The problem was, as always with the government, you know, like when the truck drivers went on strike and the petrol tanker drivers went on strike, and the government was like, "There's no need to panic, everyone. No need to panic," and everyone panics, and then you always get some shitbag MP, which doesn't really narrow it down, saying, "Oh yeah, start stockpiling fuel with jerry cans." You always get one prick that says that, and the press pick up on it, and there's always a panic, and then we get a run of petrol, and we run out because people have panicked. Well, this was exactly the thing there. The government, in their wisdom, issued a pamphlet. The pamphlet said, maybe you should destroy killing your pets, and everyone was like, you're right, we should kill our pets. So unfortunately, that as mentioned, Battersea Dogs and Cats Home, along with PDSA and the RSPCA, had really fought against this, but because they had so many people turning up at their hospitals, they had a choice. They could either euthanize the pets the best way that they could, or because they knew that a lot of people would just take their pets home and euthanize them themselves with a brick. So they felt it was best to do it the most humane way that they knew, which was, you know, their way. I think they used a gas box, I believe, thinking back to the Reg Christie episodes. Battersea Cats and Dogs Home had managed to feed and care for 145,000 dogs during the course of the war and provided a field in Ilford as a pet cemetery, where it is estimated there's more than 500,000 animals buried, many of them from the first week of the war. In total, they estimate there's 750,000 pets were killed during the course of the event, but this was ones that were legally euthanized. Therefore, obviously, there's quite a few who would have been killed during the war, but also many who were kind of killed by their owners owing to the hysteria. What else is going on? What else is going on? I think that's it. I think that's all I have to say about that. I sound like Forrest Gump now. Oh, no, there's... I was going to do a whole bit in this episode about all the other attacks that were going on around that time. Around the time that they were doing a search for Charles Connolly, three soldiers were involved in an armed hold-up in Green Park, so just around the corner. One wearing a sergeant's chevrons, who shoved a pistol in the ribs of Archibald Hulsman, who was on D-Mob at the time, and forced him into an air raid shelter. Two other soldiers, both wearing US Army uniforms, robbed the man of his paybook, wristwatch, cigarette case, fountain pen and cash, and then all three vanished. Let's not forget that around this point as well, we have the case of William Raven, who we discussed much earlier on, which was the two Canadian soldiers who were deserters. Again, they were the ones who... They hadn't eaten in ages, they hadn't had anywhere to stay, they needed clean clothes, so they robbed him for his pants and socks and murdered him. So you can see how desperate people were. Do you know, the war was over, but for many it was not over. There was still a lot to do. So right, let's do the quiz questions. Running out of steam now. Michael, come on. Question number one: what date was V-Day? It was the 8th of May. The 8th of May. 8th of May, 1945. Question two. Which two murders mentioned on Murder Mile happened before and after VE Day? So just before VE Day, a couple of days before Hitler was murdered, was Jacques Tratzert murdered his family in the Cornhouse tea room. And just after VE Day, Elizabeth McClendon was murdered, and she was the King of Greece's maid. So there you go. For question three, what foodstuff was first rationed after the end of the Second World War? It was bread. Question four, roughly how many looting cases did the Old Bailey hear during the war? Nearest to the 100th, we'll get this. It was 4,584. Question five. How much was a ration sheet sold for on the black market? It was £10 then, which is roughly £400 today. Question six. What was the name of the man who claimed his home had been bombed 19 times over 5 months? He was Walter Handy. Question seven. How many soldiers were executed for desertion during World War II? The answer was none. Although 306 were executed for desertion in World War I. Question eight. What year was the Geneva Convention? 1929. Question nine. How many years in prison would you get for malingering? It was up to 2 years. And question 10, what was Robert Blaine's alias? It was Reginald Douglas Johnson. So there you go. There you go, folks. Oh, there's that one done. So, next week, another single parter next week. I think it's a single, a single, a single, then a double. And then we go on the little break, which I've got to prepare for. So, that's me done. Thanks for listening to and supporting the podcast. Have yourself a good week. Stay safe and be good. I'm off to Costa to abuse their electricity, but not their Wi-Fi because it's shit. Have yourself a good week, folks. Stay safe and be good. Lots of love.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.